knows even why some houses are called haunted.
What would you call this place?
Diseased, sick, crazy. Such houses are described in the Bible and legends. Before that, a homeless race for the underworld. A house of Hades.
Okay.
One minute, I think. Okay. Okay. You won't hear the music, Stephen.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay.
Welcome to the Paranormal UK radio show. I'm your host, Irene Allen, and with me, propping me up today, once and as always, Christian Delaney.
Hello there, folks. Hello there, Irene.
Oh, yeah. Hello. Hiya.
And
so what we're going to do today, Christian, is we're going to get straight in with our guests instead of doing a bit of bantering here and there because, you know, the brain is not with it today. So
okay.
No. All right.
Yeah, no worries.
So, would you like to introduce our guest, Christian?
Yes, I'll try and get this correctly. So, so a warm welcome to Stephen Sakellios. I hope I pronounced that right. Is that right?
Sakellarius.
Sakellarius. There you go.
Just a little emphasis. Yeah.
Sorry about that. So, Sakellarius, Stephen. Yeah, thank you for joining us, and you're going to be talking about reincarnation, is that right?
Correct.
Oh, brilliant. I've got that right, at least.
pronounced it right, didn't it?
Yeah, that's good stuff. So, I was just wondering, why reincarnation? What is it about reincarnation that floats your boat?
Well, I had studied it along with my interest in Eastern philosophy since I was about 19. I started out with the Bhagavad Gita and went on with more contemporary spiritual teachers and so on. And reincarnation just came right in with it, and it just felt completely natural to me. But when I started a little one-man video production company in 1997, I had the feeling that I should have some creative project to go along with it, or I just get absorbed into the commercial end of the thing and lose all of my creative, you know, because I started out with fine art photography and I went into video, but then I decided, well, I'll make a living at it, you know. But I'd seen other people do things like that and they lost all their creative juices in the process. I didn't want to do that, so I wanted to do some project on the side. And I literally woke up one morning and knew it was going to be about reincarnation. I hadn't given it any thought, and I don't have any explanation for that unless somebody on the other side told me, you know. I have no idea, but I know I woke up and I knew that's what my project was going to be.
So Stephen, it just came out of the blue then? It wasn't something you've been interested in since you were a little boy or something?
Well,
like that. You know, it just came out of the blue?
I have been interested in it in hindsight. When I look back on it, no, that's what it was. Yeah. I was always trying to remember something. Like when I was three, I desperately wanted not to forget. And then I forgot, and I was desperately trying to remember what it was I had forgotten. It seemed significant, you know, but I couldn't. Gradually, I lost. But I would look up at the sky and look at the Pleiades, you know, and I'd call it my question mark, and that stood for everything that I'd forgotten that I was trying to remember. And all that ties into reincarnation, but I didn't have any idea what it was. I was recognizing things and having past life memories, but I had no context for them, so I didn't know that's what it was.
Mm.
Okay, so should we start from the beginning? And we're going to ask you now. I'm going to ask you now. What actually is reincarnation?
Well,
in your estimation,
yeah, that goes to the question of what is a person. And of course, many people in these fields are coming to the conclusion that man is a spiritual being having a physical experience. So you have to start with. I think you have to start there. That we're not actually physical beings. We're temporarily having this experience and inhabiting these bodies. And, you know, and then some people say it's a school. Swami Vivekananda said it was a gymnasium. There's different explanations. You know, I love that one. But it gives an image, you know. But it's you start out with that, and then you find out, well, what is this spirit, you know? So then you find that it's kind of in layers, and I basically start with the astral body or the energy body, that's who we really are, not necessarily in the ultimate philosophical sense, but in the practical sense, that's who we are, the energy body, and we enliven and inhabit the physical body. So it's the cycle of life as opposed to the span of life. The span of life is a big scam. There's no such thing. There's only the cycle of life. And it makes sense once you see it that way that, you know, everything is cyclical. And an awful lot of paranormal investigation is seeing life in cycles, big cycles, historical cycles, cosmic cycle. And this is the individual cycle, which just means that the astral body comes into the physical body. I overheard a yogi who I very much respected telling someone that it was 21 weeks, that the soul enters the fetus at 21 weeks. So I have that on good authority. And then, you know, we live out our span. Every night we leave the physical body, you know, and come back again. We don't remember it. You know, every time we dream and sleep, we're out. And then there's other people that have near-death experiences or have out-of-body experiences, which I had one little one once, enough to convince me that it was real many years ago. And then, but all during that time, there's something called the silver cord that connects the astral body with the physical. As long as that's intact, you come back. When that's severed, you go on to the astral realm.
You say goodbye.
Say bye, and then you cycle back in again at some point. It could be very soon. It could be, by our time, hundreds of years. It just depends on many factors. Yeah.
And do you actually think that we do choose our parents?
My take on that...
Or our family.
Yeah, my take on that... First off, there's karmic connections that pull you, you know, feel...
Mm.
But as far as choice goes, I think of it as like being in college, where the freshman doesn't get too many choices. They have to take the electives, you know. But then the senior, you know, has a lot of choices about, you know, whether they want to take this semester or that semester. They probably need the course at some point, but they get to decide, you know, when they're going to take it and so on. And who, you know, who's going to be their professor, for example, or who's going to be their classmates. So that's the way I look at it, that as we advance a little bit, we get more choice in these things. And I also think that we have help from guides on the other side with these things.
Yeah.
Who do you think those guides are?
Well, they would be people who are more advanced than ourselves. I would assume that have lived more lifetimes and had more experience and more wisdom than ourselves.
Yeah, I often think, Stephen, that, you know, with these guides on the other side, if you are going to be, say, like a great artist, maybe your guide on the other side is a great artist that will help to bring your gift forward. Or a great pianist or something
like
that.
Makes perfect sense to me, you know, absolutely.
Because the difference between a spirit guide and a guide and a guardian angel is that the guide has actually lived on the earth plane at one time.
Right, that's my understanding. That's mining. Yeah. And the other interesting thing about prodigies like that is that I believe that if you're going to really excel in any field, it takes several lifetimes, not just one.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you see somebody that comes in and they're a prodigy, that's because they've been doing this for five or six lifetimes.
So what do you think of that then, Christian?
That's probably absolutely right, because if you think about every generation learns something new, and for them to get to that zenith, that plateau of true understanding of your role and purpose in this reality, the only way you're going to achieve that is by each generation handing down something really useful for that next generation to use. The old adage is, you always get handed down something from your grandparents. So if each generation does that, in theory, there will be a finished article somewhere along the line, generationally, so that person can understand our purpose and understand the reality that we live in and how we can coexist with the different possibilities. And I think, what was it? Somebody said something about carne being flesh. Is that right? Carne? In reincarnation, carne means flesh.
Oh, I don't know. That's not learning something new.
Carne is meat in Italian.
Yeah, that's right. So carne, reincarnation, the actual word, if you break it down, carne is flesh. Yeah. And the re-in is the reinvention of your persona, your spirituality, your going back into the body. So if it's a cycle of generations recycling that original person and then sort of melding in different generations, then there's an opportunity to reach different plateaus and, as the Buddhists say, reach that those special places of contentment and understanding of purpose. That's how I understand it. I don't know if you agree with that. I don't. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I think. Sorry, Stephen.
That's okay.
I
Your think brain's working pretty good. That you,
I think it's brilliant that you broke that word down like that.
Well, I did. I've always been involved in it.
I've never thought of it.
The reason I broke it down like that is because when I'm good, I had an experience which I've told you, Irene, about many. Mm. Within that experience, within it, I got a message that, with our true purpose as sentient beings, part of the cosmos and part of this reality, is that we are to ascend to an understanding of our purpose, which is to truly embrace the possibilities of spirituality. And that is our goal, our purpose. That's why we're here.
So all these reincarnations alive, right, are to learn the things that we never learned in the previous life so that we can ascend to this particular position.
Well, I think that it's impossible to get it all at one time because things come in opposites. So you tend to, for example, the person that values strength, they tend to pursue that, but at the expense of other qualities like gentleness or, you know, sensitivity or so on. So you spend a couple...
You've got to learn these lessons.
Yeah, so you spend two or three lifetimes becoming strong and learning what it means to be strong, but then you realize, or you come up against situations or you just feel within yourself, you know, I've gotten rather... tough and insensitive and uncaring, you know, I need to go back and pick up the other half of this thing, you know. So then you got to come back and learn how to be gentle and sensitive and compassionate and so on, you know. But eventually you get to the point where you can be strong and gentle at the same time, you know. You brought it to a new level, then you can work on some other for a while, you know, and I think that's how it progresses.
Right. Any more questions, Mark?
yeah, I've got loads.
God, I'm getting my co-host muddled up here, aren't I?
I was going to ask you. You know, you were talking about the Eastern religions and the Eastern sort of way of looking at reincarnation. What do you think about the Egyptian way of looking at reincarnation?
I know very little about it, but my impression is that what we know of the Egyptian religion is the watered down version. That, in other words, we can't go back far enough to see what they really believe. So if now if we look at them 3,000 years ago and they worshiped the sun, several thousand years before that they worshiped the spirit and the sun was a symbol, and then they lost sight of that, you know, and they started worshiping the actual sun itself, and so on with the mummification and leaving things in the tomb that you can take with you and all of that. That's kind of, to me, that's watered down version. We're not able to see back when they understood better than that. So I can't judge the Egyptian religion, except that I have a feeling we're not seeing the original thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was something they talked about called the Diawat, which in one of the, I can't remember which pharaoh it was, but it kind of runs through right the way through Egyptian sort of their society. The Diawat was a place where their spirits would go, and the Diawat was like this fantastical place of rebirth. So it would be an opportunity for your spirit to reinvigorate and come back as something else, whether that be an animal or even a plant. and sometimes obviously another human being. But it's interesting that they came up with that idea and had a place for it as well.
But I think all cultures have something like that, seems to me, you know. But I do think that the idea of reincarnating as anything less than a human being is a distortion. That's my understanding, that actually doesn't happen.
So you don't think pets come back to us in this life?
Oh, yeah, but people don't come back as pets. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, I understand.
The pets come back,
yeah.
Absolutely, and they, at some point they'll come back as people.
So if you're a dog, you're a dog. That's
Well, no, you'll get to be a monkey at some point, and, you know, a dolphin and a human being, yeah. So they're going, in other words, you go upwards, but you don't normally. Now, there might be exceptions, but normally you don't go back down. Misunderstanding of it, yeah. Which is important, because I think people lose respect for the idea of reincarnation when they think that it means retrograde incarnation into lower forms. I think that doesn't make intuitive sense, and they just throw the whole thing out at that point.
Right.
Hmm. Yeah, well, like you said, it's going backwards, isn't it? You know, absolutely silly. What about ghosts? Why have we got ghosts if there's reincarnation? Why do you think we see ghosts in houses
probably know this. There's two different kinds of ghosts, and one of them is just is not really a being, but like a recording.
That's some heavy
impression, and it leaks through and manifests physically, and you see this loop, like a video loop, you know, running.
Yeah.
So that's one type. The other type is actual beings who have become earthbound some reason or other. Well, they can't reincarnate. They have to get into the higher astral realm before they can reincarnate, and they could be stuck there for hundreds of years, as I understand. It's a very bad situation for them.
So,
and there are people that rescue them, that try to get them out of that. You know, there's people that are involved in that work.
Yeah, I used to be one. So what you're actually saying is then that they're held back by either trauma in their life, one thing
or attachment,
another.
or whatever it is. Yeah.
Or attachment, yeah, like my ghost here in this house. Yeah. This house is full of them, but it's the attachment to the house. They built the house from farmland. They built the house on farmland.
So it's theirs.
You know, theirs, theirs. It's, you know, it's always going to be yours, Herbert.
So they will reincarnate eventually, but they have to get out of that condition.
Well, this is it. I believe that in the position that my ghosts are in, that they are held back because of the love of the house. Mm. I have no right to shift these ghosts on.
Yeah.
You know?
No, not to force them. No, you know, you could suggest it to them.
I have done once or two, twice, you know, when things have actually gone missing, and I know that I've put it down there right in front of me, and the next minute it's disappeared, and it's something like my glasses. Mm. But, and, you know, then you hear me kind of...
You guys want to go somewhere else,
Now!
What do you think about consciousness in relation to reincarnation?
Well, I have to go back to the teachings that I've studied, and those teachings say that the whole process of incarnating upwards through the vegetable and animal kingdom is the process of developing full consciousness, and that once you hit the human being, become a human being, you have full consciousness, but it is circumscribed by all the mental impressions that you've gained through all of those experiences. And therefore, you can only see through the filter of those impressions. And that from then on, the job is to thin out those impressions so that you can see the truth.
Hmm. I understand.
Yeah.
It's about perspective, isn't it? It's about
And also that evolution is really driven by consciousness, not by survival of the fittest.
Absolutely.
One thing that often I think about is, do you know, you can see somebody one day sometimes and you think, oh, they're an old soul or they're a young soul. What do you make of that? Do you think that these young souls are they've now come into the human life, but this is maybe one of, they've only been here as a human one or two times
before.
Well,
it's tricky to say, because when people reincarnate, they don't bring their whole mind and everything they've learned in, necessarily. Mm. They bring in the part that they're going to need to learn something. So you can't, I was told this by a wise lady that was like a mentor to me many years ago, you can't really judge how advanced somebody is by what you see in one lifetime, because they may have just brought in just that part, you know. But that being said, there are old souls and young souls.
You can usually see it in babies. When you look at a newborn baby, you think, "Oh, this baby's been here before. This is an old soul." Yeah.
There was a nurse that what was it? She told me she was a neonatal nurse, and she said that you could see the personalities in newborns. She said clearly, which was interesting. Yeah.
That's probably true.
Well, I think so, because that's where, you know, I look at newborns straight away. To me, they're either old souls or young souls. So I'm seeing a personality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't think, because I watch my grandchildren grow up, and I've got 9 grandchildren, I think. I'm still counting. Yeah. But, you can see the difference in them. And it's not, I don't know, it's something, it's like a psychic thing that you actually see the old soul or the young soul, you know?
Yeah. I also...
My mother was, I believe, was a lot younger soul than myself. She was so naive about the silliest of things.
I do think that for a long, long time in this process, it's necessary for people to believe in this world and their bodies. Otherwise, they can't learn the lessons they need to learn. You know, they won't learn the moral lessons they need to learn if they don't take it seriously. You know, so for a long period of time, you have to be convinced that you are your body and this world is real, and you know, and so on. But eventually you get to the point where it gets a little looser on you, and you start to think, you know, I don't think this is real, and I don't think I'm really my body, you know. But that needs to kind of come naturally when you're ready for it.
Mm-hmm. And anything kind of jump in on a pregnancy besides the soul?
I don't know. I have read cases. Dr. Ian Stevenson, you know, did scientific research on reincarnation, and very few of his cases look like, what would they call it? There's a name for it, a walk-in, you know, the child has a terrible fever and dies, and then when they wake up, it's a different person. You know, completely different person. And there's documented cases like that. And there's one where the different person stayed for quite some weeks or months. Waleska case. Yeah. And then eventually left. And, you know, the person came back, you know, but it was like for, you know, several weeks. So I think it's possible, but I'm pretty sure there are safeguards against that. You know, the guardian beings that are making sure that doesn't happen and so on. Normal, in normal cases. There's always exceptions to almost anything, you know, but normally that's not permitted to happen.
Okay. What are you going to say something?
Well, loads, but I'll just try and keep it.
Oh, go on then. I'll sit back for a second.
It's good to listen, because you've said some really good questions. I was really interested in your view of the coexistence of spirituality in the context of reincarnation and the rise of the digital world, the robotics and our reliance on technology. How do you see the future panning out with both those very distinct different parts of humanity?
Well, the general principle is that you pursue something as long and as far as you can pursue it until you get to the ultimate conclusion of the thing. It's like alcoholics that have to hit rock bottom, if you want to look at it in that way. But once you go down a mistaken path, you have to go all the way down it, you know, and come to the logical conclusion and done with that completely. So we have gone down the path as a culture, gone down the path of materialism, you know, and we have to take it to its ultimate nasty conclusion. If it wasn't for this idea that we are this body, we never, and that this physical world is paramount and real, we never would have developed this stuff in the first place, because it wouldn't have occurred to us to be important to bother with. you just wouldn't put that much energy into it. I mean, the people in the East put their energy into sitting down and meditating and exploring their states. They didn't have any interest in creating robots. It's not that they couldn't. Those people were plenty intelligent, but they didn't have the inclination because it wasn't important to them. They didn't believe that. See? So we have to take it to the ultimate conclusion. And I have gone, for the last 2-3 years, I've gone to the University of YouTube. And there's a lot of good stuff on there. And one of the things that I've studied just about all the conspiracy theories and everything else, but I've studied is the artificial intelligence and what they anticipate, dangers and so on. And I think it's extremely dangerous, because if you have a robot that can learn and repair itself and act autonomously, the thing is going to decide that people are superfluous, at some point. They're not efficient.
Become self-aware.
I don't think they can become self-aware. See, that's a huge mistake. But they can think. Right. I mean, in the sense that your computer can think, they can. I mean, artificial intelligence is still artificial. It's never going to jump from being actual. they could decide that human beings are annoying and inefficient and unnecessary. Mm. If they're programmed, in other words, because. They're not being programmed. They're programming themselves. That's the problem. So you don't know where they're going to end up. There was one. I saw one where, let's see if I can remember correctly, the artificial intelligence was identifying wolves and dogs. It was distinguishing between wolves and dogs, but they didn't know on what basis it was doing that. So they rewrote the program to figure out what was it using to decide what's the difference between a dog and a wolf, and it was the snow. Around the picture. That's all it was. So it would say that it was a wolf, You don't know what basis the thing is making its decisions on. Mm-hmm. So if it's making ethical decisions, like, for example, they want to have robots that can arrest people based on whatever criteria, Well, we don't know what criteria that thing's going. It's like deciding that it's a wolf instead of a dog. I think it's incredibly dangerous, and we would never go there if we understood in the first place that man is a spiritual being and not a being.
I think it's interesting that, it's a good point you raised there. I think as sentient beings, we naturally crave social interaction, and that social interaction is very, very carnal, in the sense it can be touch. And it can also be spiritual. It can be love. It can be emotional. Now, I'm not so sure that Facebook and all these other social media platforms necessarily give us that. And even YouTube, which has apparently an algorithm, which tells us in a way what we can watch and deciphers what it thinks acceptable and what's not acceptable. Mm. And it's an interesting way of trying to disseminate what they think is, right for our reality. And I think it's, in a way, like you said, you were a dangerous road to go down. And I would agree, because if we put too much faith in artificial intelligence, we'll get even more lazy, and we'll go away from our purpose, which is to explore our potential. And we will lose out on these important interactions because we're relying on social media to do it for us, or maybe programs to give us the insights into things when we could actually go and see these things.
I think it's very rare for people to really relate to anybody in any depth on Facebook. It's by its very nature, it's superficial. And, somebody wants to be a friend. It cheapens the idea of a friend. What is a friend? I wiped them all out. I unfriended everybody.
Did you
recently.
Wipe that?
Yeah. Because they wouldn't look at my video that I, before that, this piece about reincarnation, nobody would even look at it. And these are people who supposed to believe in reincarnation.
You tell them, Stephen.
I unfriended the whole lot of them. I told them I was going to do it.
Did you find yourself getting upset by Facebook emotionally?
Not too much.
Oh, okay.
Not too much. Yeah, it was more a practical matter because I feel like I'm moving into a new phase in my life. I almost feel like karmically I've died and started a new incarnation, and it's just everything's new, and I'm just going to start with friends that I can really be myself with and not worry that they're going to not be able to handle something that's important to me. You know, I just, I don't need that. And they got plenty of friends. I don't think they really care that much, you know. So I just, you know, it wasn't so much vindictive as it was, let's start afresh for me.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good idea. Remember, people, there is a delete button on Facebook if anyone gets on your nerves.
I was going to say that artificial intelligence is very, very smart and very stupid. You know, I mean, machines are generally very stupid. So the artificial intelligence, this algorithm on YouTube, has decided that I'm like 18 years old and looking for a cop. And the reason they did that, I've been writing to college professors with some of my theories. You know, and when you get on the website, you have to, they have cookies, and you have to accept it because they put a huge banner over what you're trying to see, you know, so you can accept that they use cookies. Well, so I just fudge to get rid of it, you know. I'll say yes. So now YouTube is giving me all these ads for colleges. I'm 65, you know. So that's how stupid and smart it is at the same time.
Oh dear, never mind. Right, what about children and reincarnation?
Well, this is what Dr. Ian Stevenson studied, was children who have exceptional memory of past lives. And the reason he did that is that they can't possibly have gotten the information from anywhere else. You study adults, and maybe they saw a movie, maybe they read a book, maybe somebody told them about it, they've forgotten it, and think they're remembering something, but it's false memory, what they call cryptomnesia. So he eliminated that whole question by just studying children, because, you know, some of them just learning to talk, and they tell their parents, you know, you're not my real parents, I live in such and such a village and these are my parents, you know. and they had no experience of that village or anything, you know. So like, for example, James Leininger case, the little boy that remembered being a World War II pilot, they didn't watch movies like that. So they take him to the airplane museum, and his mother, you know, he's like three, and his mother says, so, well, look at that bomb under there. He says, Mommy, that's a drop tank. they know things. There's no way they should know. So, but I believe personally that just about all children have past life memories up until about the age of seven. But what happens is
once they start going to school and start learning, that's when
tell their parents and their parents hush them up, then of course they're, you know, they'll shut up about it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. But there have been some amazing stories out there with children that have had past lives.
Yeah.
You know, from all around the world. I was watching one the other day about a little boy that lived in Glasgow.
Yes.
And have you heard that
one?
Yeah,
go ahead. I've seen it.
Yeah. Well, he kept saying from a very early age that he had another mummy and daddy, and he lived on the island of Barry, about 250 miles away from Glasgow. So eventually they took him there. He was able to point a lot of things out. They found the house that this family had lived in by the name that the child had given them.
Yeah, and there was no way he could have gotten that information normally.
No. And apparently the house had been owned by a Robinson family that also lived in Glasgow, but it was their holiday home. So,
but how many cases like that does it take before you say uncle? You know, I don't know.
Well, that's
you know, but how many cases does it take like that before you realize there is reincarnation is real? You know, this is my question. Mm. And there are more people apparently that accept it in Great Britain than there are in America. We're very backward around here.
Why is that?
Well, it's more materialistic. Consumerism is really a religion here.
Right.
I don't know how much it is in the UK. And also, you guys have had a little influence from India, you know, which I think had some effect. But whatever the reason, you know, we're just materialistic. We're, you know, rah rah gung ho, you know, and we really believe that either, you know, that or then the Christians are off by themselves doing their thing, and they don't have any use for reincarnation either.
Well, not necessarily, but then of course Jesus did apparently reincarnate.
Yeah, so, and he taught reincarnation too, on top of everything. And
I know.
These two his close ones.
And yet it's now in Christian orthodoxy. They don't like talking about reincarnation, and yet it's central to Jesus' life in a way, because coming back was proving that he was the Son of God. And it's ironic, in a way, that that is dismissed out of hand, because it just shows you the value of reincarnation and how it can persuade people of a certain way of looking at the world, and also that, that people have these powers, because a lot of people were disbelieving in him being the Son of God right up until the end, and then it took for him to die and then come back for some people to go, okay, I believe now.
I give up. Yeah,
you know, I can't dispute that. So, yeah. Because, you know, it was just fantastic. Not seen that before. So, it just shows you that even in scribe Orthodox religion, there's a place for reincarnation, even though it's kind of shunned a little bit, kind of given a kind of magical property, which they try and push it away and see it as kind of, I don't know, like witchcraft or something like that.
Oh yeah, it's the lie of the devil, I think, to those people.
Yeah, it's absolutely bizarre, isn't it? The way that they almost don't acknowledge it.
Here's the thing: when reincarnation was taken out, and it was deliberately taken out, a long pre-existence of the soul was made anathema, and I think it was 553 AD. And that's a intrigue that I would have to read back up on again to really discuss it in full detail. But it was part of. At least meant some of the Christian fathers accepted it. Until that point, it was driven out. You know, but now where was I going to go with that? I'm not blank. I've completely blanked on where I was going to go with that now. So let's move on. And
all right,
I think you've got my affliction.
I think I got it. Yeah, you seem to have brightened up, and now I'm it has come through the wires.
I was going to say that. In modern popular science fiction culture, there seems to be a rebirthing of things like Valhalla. And I note that one of the popular characters of the science fiction sort of rebirthing, if you like, is Thor. And Thor is descended of allegedly a super being, a god, which... was absolutely incomparable in the sense of saying, I live in a plateau of a different reality, and I'm going to send my son to sort out the mere mortals and to give them a purpose. And it took the rebirthing of Thor for him to understand his purpose. And it also, in a way, reflected back on his father and also the human race. And there's always been, like you say, in early civilization, this really interesting partnership between these super beings that were able to give us the idea of rebirthing, and through some spiritual means and by acts of good, showing us an ethical path, if you like. I've always wondered, what do you think about Hollywood embracing sort of these ideas of reincarnation and these ideas of the rebirthing of humanity? What do you think's happening there?
Well, I think it's a two-edged sword, but always when facts are suppressed, they come back around through the back door as fiction, you know, and myth. So it's always been that way, and people can relate to them and get, you know, and connect with those truths through the fiction. The down that it's watered down, you know, and sensationalized, and so on. Yeah. So you're getting in touch with these things intuitively, but you're not really getting the correct information necessarily. So I think there's room for both. I mean, I know there's a lot of reincarnation novel writers, and I think they're doing good work, and it's important. But what I'm doing is really more like what Dr. Ian Stevenson is doing, except not with children, and you know, trying to get the facts, you know, in place in such a way that, you know, and that's a difficult thing, because people, you know, it's easy to look away and just not pay any attention to it, you know. So that's my particular thing, is to try to get the actual facts and not fictionalize anything. I did actually write a fictional novel that was based on the study that I did, but that's a separate thing. In my actual ebooks, there's nothing, there's no fictional dialogue, there's no fiction at all. It's all straight, you know, actual facts.
Yeah, we're going to I want to come to that a little later on.
And I did remember the point that I was trying to make earlier. And briefly, that's just that when reincarnation was excised from Christianity, they had to put something else back in. And that's where the real shame was, because they put in one life where you either go to eternal heaven or eternal hell. So eternal hell came in at the point where they took reincarnation out. And eternal hell, it doesn't make any sense if you think about it, because eternal damnation is worse than anything that anybody could ever do to you on earth. You think about the worst torture, it's still only going to last for weeks or months or years. The worst thing that anybody could do to you is not even close to eternal hell. And yet the God of love supposedly does that to people. It makes absolutely no sense. It means that if you're going to embrace traditional Christianity, you have to embrace a tyrant. Fortunately, nobody knows where I live, because I might throw my window at this point. But, I mean, it doesn't make any sense if you think it through. And there's a lot of people that have turned away from traditional Christianity because they could not believe in a God that would do that to people. You know, but with reincarnation, you have responsibility, 100% accountability, but no eternal hell, see? So what they've done is they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. A lot of people have thrown religion out. They've thrown eternal hell out. They've thrown eternal heaven out. They've thrown the whole thing out, and they become humanists. But there's no accountability, see? Mm. That has had, if you put that along with a social Darwinism, you know, which came with Darwin, and you put those things together, you get the seeds of a sociopathic society that believes that when you die, that's the end. So then, if you believe that when you die, that's the end, you've got two options. You can be a nice person just to be nice, because it's a good thing to be nice, and then you die and it's all over. Or you might as well be a crappy person for all the difference it makes, and have more fun. You know, there's no accountability, no cosmic accountability, no accountability after you die anymore. So reincarnation puts that back in. Now you've got 100% accountability for everything you do. You know, and I think that one reason it's resisted, people realize that at some level.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Literally makes sense. Regression.
Yeah.
Through hypnosis. Now, most people that I've talked to in the past, they've been the Queen of Sheba or the King of Siam or something like this. With me, I went through regression to try and stop smoking. Now, remember this, okay? I went to see a hypnotist to try and stop smoking, okay? Many, many years ago. But instead of trying to stop me smoking, he, when he thought he had me under or whatever, he started regressing me into different various lifetimes, in which everyone I was either a pauper, married to a drunk, had a rotten life.
So much for the Queen of Sheba.
Not one person famous. Now, what do you think about regression? Do you believe that with regression through hypnosis we can reach these previous lives? Because when it happened to me, and I know that a lot of people told me this with hypnotism, you know, you're not completely dead in your head at the time it's taking place. If an aeroplane goes over the top of that building, you'll be able to hear it. If someone shuffles and moves in the room, you can hear it. But you're in that place where, you know, you can't help but answer the question sort of thing.
Well, I have experienced it, first of all, but there's good, what they call good subjects and not so good subjects, and then there's people.
I wasn't either.
There are people that go very deeply into trance very readily, and they are the ones that get the names and dates and addresses and, you know, that kind of stuff. Most of us, I think, go a little bit. I went a little bit under, and occasionally I would go a little further under, and I would get kind of bubbling out from the depth. Suddenly I would think of something. I'd get glimpses, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, one of those glimpses checked out historically in such a way that I couldn't possibly have known it normally. So, you know, from my own experience, actually a couple things, but one in particular, you know, checked out. Yeah. And there was no way I could have known it or guessed it, you know, and it checked out in about five different details. So I know it can be genuine, but there's two variables. First off is whether you're a good subject, and the second one is whether you're an honest person. because there are people that just like to fantasize and like to imagine, and there's other people that insist on the facts, you know, and won't say any. In other words, they won't, you know, the hypnotist will say, imagine you're a goose or an eagle or something, and they just won't go there because I'm not. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm like, you know. So, I mean, I got glimpses, but I'm not suggestible. You know, but that's a personality thing. There's other people that, well, I remember one that I filmed where the lady had a spirit guide who was a little red Cupid or something. I'm thinking, I don't think so. You know, I mean, I just, you know, it could be, but I kind of doubt it. You know, but she was an imaginative person, and he just had encouraged her to imagine and just let your mind go free, and she did, you know. So I think it depends on what personality type you've got as a subject, and then it depends on how deep they go and whether how susceptible they are. If you get I don't know if you've heard of Captain Robert Snow, who was a head of homicide investigation for the city of Indianapolis in America, and he was dared by a coworker to undergo a regression session. You know, so he tried to get out of it, and he tried again. Finally, to shut her up, he said, okay, I'll do it. So he went in, and he sat there for half an hour, and he's, you know, as a professional detective, he's like me. He's not going to imagine anything or pretend anything. Either it's, you know, factual or it isn't factual. So he experienced absolutely nothing for half an hour except that his back hurt in a chair. And all of a sudden, he was plunged into full sensory experiences, three in a row, you know, of different lifetimes. I mean, he was walking around in them. Very rare, I think. And the third one, he tried to disprove because it was recent. It was a minor painter in America around 1900 or something, and he ended up proving it. Like 30 points that he could have proved or disproved, and he tried his best to disprove the thing, you know, and he proved it. But, you know, I think he suffered the consequences. I think he, you know, lost his job, and I'm not sure, you know, about his marriage, but, I mean, I think he really suffered from it, from coming out that book. Yeah, it's called Looking for Carol Beckwith. That's the name of this book. It's very, very good. And that's a strong case because this is a professional investigator who used professional detective methods and trying to disprove it. You know, it's like you can't get too much stronger than that. Yeah. And this is not a trial case, but he had no way of knowing these details about this obscure painter.
Well, I've got something to tell you. For a start, that particular hypnosis session was an absolute failure because I left the building. As soon as I got to the front gate, I lit up a cigarette. But there is one person only in this world has been able to put me under hypnosis, and that's a lady called Sheila in Canada, and she does that via Skype, and she's very, very good. But my ex-co-host, Mark, he went under hypnosis. Now, this is a strange story, right? He went under hypnosis, and it turned out that he gave the name Florence Howe, Florence Marion Howe, who was actually the daughter of Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Civil War song, Battle Hymn of the Republic.
I know who she is because in a past life I blasted her in the press. Absolutely blasted her. But anyway,
I can't remember how it got round to it, but apparently I'm her sister, Laura. Laura Elizabeth Howe, born in 1850, died in 1943. She had the Pulitzer Prize for the biography of her mother, Julia Ward. Okay, Julia Ward Howe. Now, listen to this, right? The synchronicities that go between me and Laura. Not only does she look like me, and she's definitely got my eyes, different hairstyle, obviously, but, you know, you could take my hairstyle, put on her, and you'd think it was me. She has the middle name Elizabeth. My middle name is Elizabeth. She was born in 1850. I was born in 1950. Okay. What was the other things? Oh, yeah. She lived in Gardner, Maine, which I've always had an attraction to. Maine. I've also had attraction to Boston, where she was born, I believe, in Boston. But she's buried in a churchyard called Christchurch Cemetery. I was born in a village near Christchurch in Sussex. And she also had, she travelled and she loved the Amalfi Coast. Anyone will tell you the Amalfi Coast is my life. I'm there every year on the Amalfi Coast. I've got friends there. I've been going there since 1970-something to the Amalfi Coast. There were so many synchronicities between me and her. I can't remember them all now, but she, you know, she was a brilliant writer. She wrote 90 books. She even done that children's rhyme, Elephone.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Once there was an elephant who tried to use a telephone.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That one, yeah. Yeah, and she wrote, Captain January, which was later made into a film and one thing or another. So she lived between 1850 and 1943. I was born in 1950. So it would be interesting to know if I managed to get through to at least 2043 before I pop my socks.
That's pretty good. Pretty good stuff.
I've had this strong, since I found out, I've had this fascination for this woman. Literally fascinated. And the strange thing is that even as a child, I wanted to go to Boston.
Well, I was that way about Maine.
I love Maine because ever since, do you remember that television program that used to be on? Oh, that woman detective, Angela,
Lansbury?
Yeah. Oh, Murder, She Wrote.
That's set in Maine, isn't it? And Maine is meant to be very much like the UK with its autumns.
Yeah, I've moved here. I live in Maine. As a child, growing up in Miami, I always wanted to see the rocky coast of Maine. I had no particular reason to feel that way, you know.
But also, he had this very, very strong pull towards the sister. What was her name again? I've written it down. Florence. And they were very, very close, Florence and Laura. And in this life, myself and Mark were very close, you know? And it all just seems to be strange. Also, she's a writer, I'm a writer.
Well, the patterns repeat, you know, and I'm convinced that life is a loop, a looping tape or sometimes I think of it as a scientific experiment where you keep everything the same, but you change a few little things. But basically, it's a repeat, you know, so you just keep repeating the patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. She named her house Yellow House. My favorite color is yellow. I love yellow. Yellow everything. You know, I'd like to really dig a little bit further in and see if I can find out whether. At the moment, I'm not 100% convinced. It could be all synchronicities, but it just seems so strange that every time I look her up, something clicks.
Well, here's the thing: if you have any glimpses or memories or feelings, even impressions about her that you haven't looked up historically, be sure and document them, write them down, date them, and then see if you can confirm them. That's what I did in my study. You know, whenever I had a feeling of particular attraction for a certain person I saw in a photograph, or had a memory, or had a hunch about something, whatever it was, I would write it down or send it to the person that was helping me research. And then I went and looked for it, you know, and I was able to verify a whole bunch of things that way. And that's I think is where the proof comes in, because you know, some of the things that I remembered, I just had no possible way of knowing. They're too detailed, too specific, you know, and unique that I couldn't have just made them up out of thin air. You know, it has to have been an actual memory. So when you get enough of those, and I think you know, you can always prove more. You know, the question is how much is enough proof. To whom, you know, but I think to any reasonable person, I was able to prove that I had to have actually been this person in my past life. So, and anybody can do this, you know.
Well, I look at her photograph, okay, and I think about what I looked like when I was younger, and it's like looking at myself. But you, the same thing I noticed with you and what I saw on that video this afternoon, there is a similarity in your
There looks. Is, yeah, there is. The only difference is that Matthew had a bulbous end to his nose, and I can remember that he hated it. You know, that he used to, like, put that thing between his thumb and forefinger and rub it, hoping it would go away. So I think I was able to get rid of it this time. That's the only thing that really doesn't look the same as that thing on the end there. I finally got rid of it.
Just want to say, so it's 21:54. Just wanted to say.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Sorry about that.
So, okay. Also, like I said, Mark, under hypnosis, came out as Florence Howe, Florence Marion Howe. And when I look at the photograph of them, her, I can see Mark.
Mm.
It is so strange, absolutely strange. Right, so shall we get on, and would you like to mention the story?
Yes, but first Matthew, I wanted to go back a little bit to the interesting irony that Matthew severely and sarcastically criticized one of Julia Ward Howe's books. But the real, and then somebody stepped in and defended her, you know, and they were all signing with pseudonyms, so you couldn't tell who was who, and they would guess, they think they know who it is and everything, you know, and it went back and forth until the editors stopped it, you know. But I think the reason Matthew did it was because Julia Ward Howe was raising money for John Brown, the abolitionist who was about to...
Yeah, that's right.
He knew that. Matthew was raised Quaker, and he was associated with William Lloyd Garrison. He was on the side of people who did not want to use violence. So I think he was trying to reduce the sales of that book as much as he could to keep her from, you know, from because normally, I mean, he hadn't done, very rarely did he critique someone that sarcastically, you know. So I think he did it on purpose, that because he knew that book was intended to raise money for the raid. You know, it's just a guess. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that was correct. But it's interesting that here we're talking. So yeah, and I think we did have kind of a rapport when we first started talking before.
No, there was no friction there at all.
It was kind of picked
there?
Right up, you know. So I think there's a past life connection there too. It's very interesting.
Well, Julia Ward Howe, who you're talking about there, is the mother of.
Right.
If I was Laura, she would be my mother in that lifetime. So what year? Now, the person you're talking about is Matthew Franklin Whittier.
Whittier,
sorry. And what year did he actually die in? Would he have known me if I was
Laura? Yeah, I don't know if he would have known you or not. I mean, he knew of Julia Ward Howe through her book. Whether he knew her, I don't think he knew her personally. As a matter of fact, he said he didn't know her personally. But he died in 1883. He was born in 1812 and died in 1883. But he said in the critique, well, I don't know her personally, but blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Mm. So, but
1850, Laura was actually born.
There was a minister named James Freeman Clark, who was a friend of the House, and he officiated at Matthew's funeral, and I don't think Matthew liked him. I think it was arranged by his brother. So it's a very interesting convoluted, you know, connections going on there. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, so let's get to Matthew Franklin Whittier.
That's correct. He was the younger brother of a fairly famous poet, John Greenleaf Whittier. He was the little brother who nobody really knew or took very seriously, you know. But
okay, and you feel that you could have been him in a previous
life? I stumbled upon an etching of his on a website that had to do with Sarah Orne Jewett, who was one of the writers of the later 19th century. And she was one of the young women that John Greenleaf Whittier mentored, you know, and encouraged. He had a number of young poets, mostly women, that he encouraged. She was one of them. But I got on that website, and I just felt, you know, I feel like this is very familiar. So I wrote to a friend of mine who I had featured in my documentary, a fellow named Jeff Keane, who has his own reincarnation case. And I had a feeling that Jeff is psychic in a strange kind of way, that he just has this synchronicity about him. So I wrote to him and I said, I feel like this is familiar, but I can't find what I'm looking for. You know, what do you think this is? And about half an hour later, he wrote back and he said, I got deeper into the website and went to this page that has all of Sarah Orne Jewett's social circle, all the people she was associated with. And right down at the bottom is this fellow, Matthew Franklin Whittier, who's turned out that she had attended his funeral and she was friends with his brother. And I looked at that three-quarter etching, which was Matthew at about age 45, I think. And as soon as I looked at the eyes, I said, that's me. I felt it very strongly. That's me. You know, and there was nothing to...
It's the eyes, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
It is the eyes.
It was the eyes, yeah. Well, they say they're the windows to the soul.
Yeah.
Well, I looked at that and I said, that's me. But all I had to go on was the fact that he was an author and he was the brother of John Greenleaf Whittier. It didn't say anything about what kind of writing he did or what his beliefs were, his values, or what his sense of humor was, or anything about him. I mean, you can't even tell he's got a sense of humor because it's a very serious portrait, you know. And he does look quite like me, but, I mean, the eyes was the thing. And then that was in 2005, and it wasn't until 2009 that I really started researching it in earnest. And I just kept finding more and more about him. There's almost nothing known about him. There's only one series that he wrote that is publicly known. And there's nothing else known about him hardly at all. And they kind of make fun of him in the Whittier legacy, you know. They really make him out to be the scapegoat to make their hero, John Greenleaf Whittier, look better. But I found out that he wrote a huge amount, but he did it all under pen names, you know, all anonymously. So there's this huge body of work that I found that he wrote that nobody'd ever knew was his, you know. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, I've got, well, I say 1,600. I think it's more now. I haven't really counted it lately, but at least 1,600 of his published pieces, you know, that of all, not just in humor or satire, but poetry and essays and adventure stories and travelogues and reviews and everything else. He did everything, you know.
And also there's this this suspicion about the poem The Raven.
Yeah, it's not a suspicion anymore for me. I proved it. Matthew wrote that poem, definitely. I don't know if you guys can link to that video on my section. That would be wonderful if you can do it. But
I will put it on.
It would be great if you could do it.
Network page,
but I mean, it took a long time. What happened was that under hypnosis, that was one of the things I remembered, was meeting with Edgar Allan Poe. And I had no interest in Edgar Allan Poe, no reason for that to come up. It just came up out of the blue. And I remembered sitting with him on a porch and us kind of, you know, trying to check each other out, like, who is this guy? Not like we were friends, but we were kind of seeing, who is this guy, you know? And like an intellectual sparring almost. And when I had a psychic reading, I also used a couple psychics in my research. And the psychic told me it is possible to find this in the historical record, but it's going to take an awful lot of digging. And so I just left it alone for a long, long time. I actually didn't want to research it because I wanted somebody else to research it so I wouldn't prejudice the results by my being involved in it, you know. And eventually I realized nobody's going to do this for me. I'm going to have to do it myself. So I started, you know, looking into it, but I just stumbled into information. And what the information showed was that Matthew apparently could not come out publicly and protest this thing because he was an agent for anti-slavery agent, secret agent for abolition. Many, you know, there were many people that worked undercover, the Underground Railroad and things. Well, he was one of them, and he could not identify himself publicly. So what he did is he would make snide remarks in his published works. You know, he would put that person on notice. You know, I know what you did, and here's my little tricky analogy that posterity will understand, you know. So when you know what to look for and you know the way that he wrote, you can see very clearly what he was saying. You know, it's obvious that he was protesting that Matthew had stolen that poem from him.
Matthew had stolen
it? No, I don't know how I said that. No, that Edgar Allan Poe had stolen it. I mean, I can go into how, but, you know, that would take us a little time, but it was obvious that Matthew was telling Poe that he knew that he had stolen it. And I think he was leaving clues for posterity so that if anybody looked into it, they'd have something to go on and could figure it out. I don't know that he knew that it would be him that came back to do it, which I think is pretty interesting stuff.
I think he'd be pretty amazed, don't you? He's come back and he's exposing himself.
He didn't believe in reincarnation until about 1850 he started considering it. You know, until then, he was against it. He didn't believe it. He believed in spiritualism, and spiritualists generally do not believe in, you know, Swedenborg and spiritualism. They don't believe in reincarnation.
No.
They're traditional Christians who have gone into the mediumship end of things. But after 1850, he started believing it. By 1857 or so, he did believe in it. And there's one clue in, I think it was 1856, in a travelogue. It looks as though he was saying, to his future reincarnation, I wrote this other travelogue. You know, in other words, he, you know, this travelogue that was attributed to somebody else, he wanted posterity to know that he had really been the author. So maybe 5 or 6 years later, when he starts another travelogue, he ties it in with the first one very clearly, because the first one was named Quails, and he had a byline that said, on the wing. That was his, you know, motto, right? So when Matthew starts this other travelogue 5 or 6 years later, he starts it out with on the wing. So he's saying, I was the writer of this first one. And then he talks about the river Lethe, the Lethean stream, which is, the, in Greek mythology, is the river that we get dipped in to forget about our past lives, you know? So knowing the way that he, you know, knowing the way that he gave clues, I think he was telling his future self, I wrote that other travelogue. So he was passing a message on. I can't prove it, but that's what it looks like to me, that he was literally passing a message on to his self.
Now, how did you feel just when you actually realized that?
About?
How did you feel yourself to realize that he was giving you a message?
Well, it's a good question. How I don't know. I mean, in a sense, I already knew, you know. But a part of me was really amazed, and a part of me says, well, I already know this, you know. But here's what I actually thought. I remember now what went through my mind. I said, well, I'm you. I already figured this out. Remember, I'm you. So I'm ahead of you. I already figured it out. So it was interesting to get the message, but it was unnecessary because I'd already figured it out.
So, but Edgar Allan Poe, he did not only just take the raven, did he?
Well, as near as I can tell, see, I got to give a little bit of background on this. Matthew's wife, who figures really big in all of this, she was brilliant, and she had died in 1841, March of 1841. She died of consumption. She was a mystic, and she knew the occult. She probably was psychic. She'd studied the ancient Western teachings and the Eastern teachings and so on. And she tried to convince Matthew of these things, and at first he would just make fun of them and gradually began to believe them intellectually. But he really didn't really assimilate deep down. It was an intellectual acceptance. So when she died, he struggled because he believed it, but he didn't believe it. He's kept fighting with his skeptical self, terrible battle in himself. And I remembered when I found her tomb, it has an epitaph on it. It says, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. And it suddenly came to me that I struggled and struggled with that because it made no sense. Because if they're dead, how can they be blessed? You know, they're dead. You know what I'm saying? What difference does it make? So I remember going back and forth and back and forth. It just drove me crazy with this. Well, that's what he was doing in The Raven. When he wrote The Raven, see, all of Matthew's work is literal. And what I like to say is he took his actual experience. If his actual experience was a photograph, he put it into Photoshop and he applied the filters. He just messed with it a little bit so it wouldn't be recognized as him. But basically it was his literal autobiography. Everything he wrote was like that, either his or somebody else's experience. He wrote almost completely from real life. So that was his actual experience. He was sitting late at night reading occult books and religious books that had belonged to Abby. You know, her metaphysical books. And he did that. He stayed up late at night, you know, studying. So he's staying up late at night studying, and he's hoping for a visitation from her, but he's scared to death of it at the same time. Okay? So, you know, he hears a scratch at the window, and he thinks maybe that's her. Now, all the elements in the poem were literal. The purple curtains were something that used to be a wall hanging, which I remembered, that Abby, coming from an upper-class French family, had used to cover the walls in one of their apartments. He had them made into curtains, apparently, but that was like one of the few things he'd kept of hers. So it was very sentimental to him. So if something came in through that window, through those curtains, that was her. See, in other words, that symbolized her, those curtains. The bust of Pallas, that was the bust that one sees was found at Herculaneum. It looks quite a bit like her. And it symbolized her. It is a palace.
I've been to Herculaneum.
Have you? I would love to go.
Yeah,
I've seen videos.
Well, it's around the Amalfitana area, Naples.
Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. Mm. So you could get a copy. I've got a copy sitting here over my computer now that some fellow in Greece carved for me out of alabaster. And you could get one back then, too. So he had a literal bust of Pallas, which is Athena. Athena is the goddess of wisdom that symbolized the wisdom that Abby had taught him, you know. And so everything in that poem except the raven actually coming through the window and sitting on the bust was literal, you know, for him. And and then the way he signed it was Quarles. That means Francis Quarles. That was something that he reviewed in 1831 back when they were courting. It probably was her. He says he had an antiquarian volume of Francis Quarles' poetry, and he reviewed it. It probably was Abby's copy. He probably was reading it when that scratch on the window came, and that's why he submitted it under blank Quarles. That was, you know, it all fits for Matthew. None of this stuff fits for Poe. For Poe, it was just stuff he made up out of his head, you know. So it's obvious. Once you know what you're looking at, the thing is not crazy. It's not conspiracy theory. It's obvious. And I get, I've written to 100 English professors in the United States whose specific areas of interest had some bearing on this or other aspects of Matthew's life. I heard back from maybe 5. 3 of them said things like, I can't help you with this. You know? One of them I teased about, you know. And 2 of them...
Sweet and short.
Short. And another one, you know, came back very patronizing, you know, explaining to me how it couldn't be possible. And I explained to him how it could be possible. He you know, I think that I don't have time for this. I can't get to take me seriously, at least not in academia. But I've got, but it's overwhelmingly obvious to me, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, I remembered meeting with Poe, so that means that you know, Matthew had to have shared this with Poe around late 1842 or early 1843, and at the same time he was sending stuff to famous writers. I mean, he went through a phase of sending this unpublished stuff to get feedback, I guess, and a few of them used it. And Poe was one of them.
Dirty trick, isn't it?
Well, he was a character. Apparently, he was, you know, I say he was a real sociopath. Because if you look at the
who you mean, Poe?
Poe, if you look at the essay that he wrote pretending to explain how he wrote that poem, it's all made up. But to have the audacity to do a thing like that, see, only a sociopath has that kind of gall. To do a thing like that, to tell the big lie and to tell it with great confidence to convince everybody. It's so big a lie, nobody can believe that they're not telling the truth. It has to be the truth because nobody would tell that big a lie. See, that's the way a sociopath works. So, you know.
Yeah, no, that's true. Very true. So, Matthew, did he actually come from Maine then?
He was born in Massachusetts, in a little rural town called Haverhill, Massachusetts.
And have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there. I've been to his grave. I've been to his house, his, you know, his childhood home. And
any of it?
Well, the grave didn't do anything. The house didn't do anything for me for many years when I looked at it on the outside. And the reason is that it's been completely remodeled. It used to be an unpainted kind of, you know, tumble down old farmhouse built in the 1600s. Of course, for you guys in England, that's nothing. I know, but you know, for here in the United States, if anything was still standing from the 1600s, that's a big deal. So it didn't look anything like it used to look. So it didn't really ring a bell. When I got inside that thing, it hit me like a ton of bricks. But unfortunately, there's a very nice fellow who's the curator, and I was the only visitor, and he wanted to sit down and talk and visit. And I'm sitting here having this tremendous emotional reaction to being in there, unexpected, because like I said, I'd never had any real reaction on the outside, but I had to maintain with this fellow, you know, and talk to him and everything, and I couldn't tell him, you know, what I was experiencing. I couldn't tell him why I was there, you know, so I had to squelch it, basically, you know, and then, of course, you know, by the time I'd been there for half an hour or an hour, it was, you know, kind of subdued by that time, but my initial reaction was overwhelming. It's not proof. I can't prove it, you know, but I can say subjectively, man, it really hit me. What it takes is the thing that you're confronted with has to be as much exactly like it was as possible. It has to be just like,
yeah.
And then there has to be emotion attached to it. If you got those
things, had they changed the inside of this house?
No, not very much.
What they had to do
because it was so many other people lived in it. But what happened was they brought the stuff back. And when it became a museum, they brought as much of the stuff back as they could. Now, this is kind of interesting. Again, I can't prove it. There's a cradle in there that's supposed to have been the children's cradle. There were four children, and it's supposed to have been the children's cradle. And I could not make myself feel anything for that cradle. So yeah. Then I visited John Greenleaf Whittier's home, the home that he lived in an adjacent town. And they also had a cradle, and that one I felt. You know, that one felt familiar, not the one in the family home.
So the other one was obviously a replicable.
I guess it fitted
the time and date.
I can't prove it. There's no proof, but I can tell you that I had the reaction to the one that was in John Greenleaf Whittier's new home, not the boyhood. You know, so it makes you wonder. But you know, like I said, I can't prove it. So what I did is I paid close attention because I had already proven the case, in my opinion. So now I was just trying to expose myself to things that were in Matthew's life to see what would happen, you know. And I got the reaction when it was exactly what it used to be and when there was emotion attached to it. So in John Greenleaf Whittier's home that he lived in Amesbury, there was a death bust, basically, you know, his head in plaster, but, you know, it was like taken when he died. And that did something to me. Seeing him in 3D, that did something, you know. I felt like I wanted to touch his nose affectionately for some weird reason, you know, but that did something. Then I went upstairs into their sister's room, their younger sister's room, and I felt it there. I felt very like I'd been there before. Like I used to visit with her there in her room, and my feeling could, I could confide in her things that I couldn't confide in our brother. Now, I don't know if it was acceptable for a brother to visit a sister in her room or not. I don't know. You know, I've never run across anything like that, but I'm assuming a brother could come visit a sister in her room, you know. But that was real strong. But again, there's no proof.
As children, even in those days, they got up to all sorts.
But this wasn't as a child. This was as an adult. Like I would come back and visit as an adult, and I would visit with her in her room and talk to her about things that our brother couldn't understand. Yeah, that's what I seem to remember.
So this particular house, the house of John, was that the actual family? Because it's your brother.
Yeah.
So was this the actual family house that they grew up in?
Yeah, in Haverhill. Yeah, it was a farmhouse. It was an old farmhouse, and that's what they'd grown up in. And it used to bother me that I didn't recognize it when I'd see it in pictures. You know, I would think, why in the world don't I get something registering on the Geiger counter, you know, with this? But then I realized they took it from a kind of a run-down, unpainted old farmhouse. They fixed it up into a nice, bright, you know, white-painted, you know, house. So, yeah. Of course, I wouldn't recognize it. Yeah, what I realized was when I saw pictures of the way it was originally, you know, I said, oh, okay. You know, that looks familiar.
Yeah. So what do you make of that, Christian?
Oh, wow. I mean, there's something beautiful about people that are able to convey sort of synchronicity through poetry. You know, what I like about poetry is it shows a real talent for understanding the deep, meaningful emotion that people can experience in their life. And, you know, the descriptions that they can do can be so much better than just writing a book. Sorry, carry on.
Oh, I was going to say, this is how we know Edgar Allan Poe didn't write The Raven. The Raven is a deeply emotional, deeply personal poem about the grief and the faith crisis that Matthew was going through. The madness depicted in it was his real feeling. I mean, grief was driving him mad, the way that I, you know, remembered about the tombstone and the epitaph. You know, was it, you know, did she survive? Did she not survive? Is there life after death? Is there not? It was driving him bananas. He couldn't let go of it, you know. And the way that Poe describes, he just kind of did it as an intellectual exercise. There's no emotion, there's no inspiration, nothing. When you read about the way he says he wrote that poem, it's impossible.
He must have been really in love with his wife.
Matthew, yeah. Yeah. Oh, she was his soulmate. There's no question about it. And I've reconnected with her. Well, the psychics that I hired acted as mediums and me back in touch with her. Yeah. So the first one told me, she said when I finally, you know, got her on the phone, she says, I was thinking about calling you an hour earlier because I've been blasted with images this whole hour. That's how eager Abby was to talk to me after all this time.
Well, that's good. And have you got a strong draw to writing poetry yourself?
No, I have an aversion to it because I feel like I'm not going to be able to do it. But Matthew felt the same way, I think. It wasn't his strong point. He actually was very good at it, but it wasn't his strong point. And he would, you know, he would apologize that he wasn't a very good poet and, you know, so forth and so on. And finally he would come out and it would be absolutely gorgeous. But then he would sign it. He wouldn't even sign it at all, or he would sign it anonymously. And I'd figure out by clues that it was his, or I recognized it. But I'm the same way. I can make myself do it. And if I make myself do it, I can come out with a pretty good poem. But now his other talents, I mean, he wrote essays, you know, and letters and so on. I've been writing like daily blog for years, and each one of them is an essay, you know, in its own right. I mean, it's effort, absolutely effortless, because comes out of me, you know. So I had that to the poetry. There's that block of feeling like, oh well, I'm not really a good poet, you know. See, the other thing was he didn't want to. He felt he was competing with his brother, who was a world famous poet. So, you know, he felt like he didn't want to compete in that realm.
Mm. Right. Yeah, it's very interesting. So you're going to carry on with this?
I think I've done the research now. I keep running. You know, for years I thought I was done, and I would run into something else. You know, I would look at it. I would find a volume or a newspaper that Matthew contributed to, and copy all of them and put them in my archive. You know, digitize and everything. But one of them would say reprinted from such and such other paper. And I knew it was his. So then I would have to go look at the other paper, and I'd find out there was 25 in there. You know?
Yeah.
And it went on like that for years that I kept, you know, that's why I've got 1,600 of his works. And I've been very careful to make sure they're really his. I'm not just grasping at straws. I want people to understand that. But I think I'm done now. You know, so now I think I'm done with the research side of it. Now I've got to try to get people to pay some attention to it. Yeah.
Mm.
I think it was, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, with Laura, I would like to go, and I would like to go to Christchurch in Maine. I would like to see her grave. I would like to go to the Yellow House and see the house.
Well, you know, should,
to see if there is
it.
Any of these strong connections to her. But like I said, you know, I even at my age now, I still think I bear a resemblance. It's the eyes. It's that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like a pretty strong case to me from what you're saying. I think it's... I wonder how far it is from Portland. I wonder if I could get there.
Christchurch, Maine.
Yeah.
That's where she's buried, in Christchurch Cemetery in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So where Christchurch is from Portland, I don't know.
I have to look it up.
Mm.
Yeah, but I mean, if you can, if there's any way to do it, I think it'd be worthwhile to get back there and see what comes up.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to do it soon before I get too old. I wouldn't mind doing it. Well, just out of curiosity there, really. You know, I wouldn't go as far as you've gone with recording everything, because I don't feel that strong. I'm not sure whether it's just synchronicities or whatever.
Have you ever seen Dr. Peter Ramster's work? He's an Australian psychologist.
No.
He would put people under hypnosis, and then he would take them to the places that they remembered. Well, there's one lady, an Australian lady. He takes her to France, where she remembered. She gets out. It's on. There's a video of it. You can find it. She gets out of the car, and she breaks down sobbing and screaming.
Yeah.
You know, because she remembers, I remember, it's her house and the church and everything, just like she had remembered under hypnosis and drawn it. There's a tree coming out of the top of a castle-like thing, just like she had drawn, you know. You know, but it was very emotional for her. So you don't know what's going to happen until you get there. I didn't think I was going to feel anything inside that farmhouse either, but like I said, it hit me hard. I was able to maintain. I just squelched it. You know?
Did you go into all the rooms? Did you feel one particular room was stronger than the others? Maybe
his
where
sisters.
He sat
yeah,
and wrote.
Sisters.
Oh, in existence.
No. I mean, I knew where John Greenleaf Whittier would have sat and written, and where he would have visited with Matthew. I didn't really get anything off of that. I knew where they would have sat when Matthew visited him in a parlor.
Yeah.
But I didn't get anything out of that. I got it was in his sister's room, and it came to me. I used to come in here and talk to her privately about things that we could talk about in front of her brother. That's what I got pretty strongly, and I felt the sense of her, like she was there almost. I felt her presence, you know. And that was really it. I would say strongest thing. That and the cradle, which I don't have any way to prove that that was really a cradle. It was at the farmhouse, but I felt that.
Yeah, they could have, when they were clearing it out, when other people were living there, they could have moved it to the other house.
Well, each place, each museum claimed that that was the family cradle, see? So yeah. One of us, they both were, but I mean, one of them wasn't, one of them wasn't, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And you didn't feel anything at all at graveside?
No, but see, that's not something I saw. For one thing, I think that stone's been replaced. They're all the same. I think that they've all they've replaced all of them at some point in memory of John Greenleaf Whittier. So I don't even think that was the original stone. So even if I saw it after I passed on, you know, after I left the body, it wouldn't have been a stone. So there's nothing there that I would recognize. See, and that's the thing. You can be right on the cords. That's been my experience. I don't know if that's everybody's experience, but my experience has been like right according to the place where I died in that lifetime. But if that hotel has been wiped, that is in Boston, Maverick Square. Yeah, there's a hotel called the Maverick House. It was like, I think, 4 stories tall, and it was right in this little area right there in Maverick Square. And they tore it down, and I think it was 1927, and recently they built a health center a few years ago. Health center is almost exactly the same dimensions. But the only thing I got as I was walking from the car, I felt some heaviness in my stomach. And I had forgotten that under hypnosis, I remember terrible sharp pains in my stomach, like I died of with an ulcer or something. And I'd forgotten that. And as I approached this building, I felt some little heaviness in my stomach. I went in, you know, to the fourth floor where they had a little museum that had everything. I didn't feel anything, you know, nothing.
No.
Yeah. Well, so it was very strange when it get triggered and when it didn't, but it seemed to be, it had to really be the actual thing I had seen. If you know, if I put myself on the same piece of land, it didn't there could be it.
Well, I find strange really that there's a connection between both her stories. And you know, like you said, when yesterday, there was no awkwardness between us.
True, that it was. You know, you've had that every once in a while, that experience that you just feel like you're picking up where you left off. It's completely like you're just very comfortable and you just sit down and pick up where you left off. And yeah, it felt like that. Yeah, for me.
It was strange, very strange. I wonder how you would have felt if.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I like I said, to my knowledge, I didn't know Julie Ward Howe in that life, but I could possibly have run into her children later, you know, possibly. Yeah. Because I lived in, he lived in Boston from 1861 until his death in 1883, so he knew, you know, a lot of the writers then. How old was Jen, say, in, 1870s?
She was born in 1850.
Okay.
I was born 100, exactly 100 years later, that's 90.
But I mean, in your past life, when were you born? 1850.
So 1850. Yeah.
So, see, when he moved to Boston 61, you would have been 11, and then maybe by 1870, you would have been a young woman. He very easily could have met you. Yeah.
He could have done.
Where did you say she lived?
Well, she lived in Boston, but when she got married, that's when she moved to Maine.
I mean, Matthew went back and forth between Portland and but yeah. So quite possibly, you know, there's no reason why not. I haven't run into any, you know, into them. But
she's written over 90 books.
If she was a prolific author, then he would have met her, because he knew the literary, you know, he knew people in literature. You know, he made a point to meet them.
She's written over 90 books and. Children's books, novels, everything.
Yeah, he would have known her almost for sure, because for one thing, if she published in the literary newspapers in Boston and Portland, and he was publishing in the same papers, you know.
Yeah, so, the whole family were writers.
Yeah.
His sister as well. Yeah. It was like got the Pulitzer writing the biography of her mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if I ever come across it, I'll let you know, because I never know what I'm going to find. So, correspondence, letters, you know, those things pop up.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, so you never know.
Yeah. Well, I wish I was half as good a writer as her. That's all I can say.
Might be. You just got to get over writer's block and start doing it, and then back to you. I think not all past talents are made accessible. Only the ones that you're, for whatever reason that is, you know. Like, for example, I found it, I'm completely at home doing it, you know, but I shouldn't be. Why? You know, I mean, I had counseling training, so I learned how to, you know, counsel people, but it's more than that, you know. And you look at Matthew, and he was known as a brilliant conversationalist. I mean, this, you know, and he used it in his undercover work, that bonhomie, you know, that he was able to summon.
No, yeah.
It was a talent that he had, and that seems to have carried over from. But on the other hand, he did booking, and you know he was good at math, and I can't do any of that kind of thing.
Oh,
his handwriting was beautiful, and mine is awful. So those talents didn't come through, but the writing and the, you know, some other things. Yeah, and those are the things I guess that I need. I don't need those other things.
Yeah, but earlier on, you know, there are things to learn in this life.
Well, one for me, that's a good topic. What have I learned? You know, what's different?
Yeah.
And Matthew used sarcasm. Rather, he used it as a weapon for good idea, but sometimes he just used it, you know? and I'm sure he heard a lot of things doing that. And I have learned, I was that way as a teenager. You're very much like Matthew as a teenager, but I have learned to go beyond that, be careful about how I use sarcasm.
Yeah, you could just hit the Facebook delete button, you do.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was time to clean house. Those people didn't mind it. Most of them had stopped seeing my posts anyway. You know? Because when I announced it, they don't even see the announcement, you know. So, you know. But friendship is taken way too lightly on Facebook.
Yeah.
Friendship is a deep, sacred thing, in my opinion. It's not to be taken lightly like that.
Yeah, I agree.
So now, Christian.
Yeah.
Any more questions you got?
I remember many years ago watching a film. I can't remember which film it was. In The Eagle Has Landed, maybe. Where a German officer talked about Carl Gustav Jung. And Jung was one of these type of philosophers and scientifically minded type of people who were fixed in a way by synchronicity. He often point to it as one of those enormous of the human condition, being that he can never scientifically explain why synchronicity happened. So he ended up being obsessed with synchronicity because it became like an adversary and a friend.
Well, like Captain Robert Snow was with his hypnosis results. He desperately tried to disprove those things. You know? Yeah.
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 Yeah. And so what Jung would oft, I think he perhaps been the journey, if you like, into the world of synchronicity, thinking, well, I'll be able to explain this.
Yeah. Yes.
But unfortunately, he realized in the end that actually synchronicity can't always be explained, but is incredibly parapsychological.
I could give a couple of examples when we get a little ahead, but
What I wanted to say. I wanted to say one of the greatest things of our time could not get to grips with what synchronicity was all about, because it's so complex. Mm-hmm. It was about spirituality. It was about things happening at the same time with different people, but there was no rhyme or reason for it. They just happened, and then suddenly this man could explain it. But from the scientific perspective, he struggled a lot with it, and then he then embraced it once he realized it was just what synchronicity is, which is this incredible bond between people that may not have met before. And it's a beautiful realization in a way. And synchronicity is a bridge between science and parapsychology. So I think it's these things you've talked about and Irene have talked about, you can't always rationalize it.
That's true. Yeah.
But it's beautiful, as we can.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it. I love the fact that it can't always be explained by science.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's this thing unique and very heartwarming about that connection, something real, which makes us human.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're trying to say in his in his philosophy toward...
That's a good point, because I have a tendency to explain everything down to the last, you know, tiny detail, you know, but there is a place for mystery, you know. That's, no matter how much you try to explain, you're not going to really understand it, I don't think. You know, there's deeper understanding that goes beyond that. So
I often find with synchronicity, I often catch myself out, like little things that come up in life that make me think to make myself think about ethics. Sometimes I criticize things in other people's eyes and then realize I've done them myself. And that kind of dawning moment is like almost synchronistic. Because it's
it has to be openness too, because
it's like a truth. And synchronicity is another way of understanding the purpose of our lives and what humanity and what we're for, what our purpose is for, to explore spirituality and to explore our connections, and I love that. I think it's amazing. So that's why I've spent more time listening to you and to Irene, because I love that those really amazing experiences. It's so good to listen to. So what do you think the future holds for you in synchronicity?
Well, I don't know, but I do get a sense of being guided. That I do get a sense that the track that I'm on is it's very much being I go back to the same word. I feel guided. I feel like, you know, no matter what I'm trying to do, there's an agenda in the spirit world, and then they're working through me. And my job is just to have the guts to get out there and believe that it's possible. <You know? laughs> I have to stop telling myself, oh, I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I'll never do this, and I'll never be able to, you know, get in front of an audience, and I'll never get any recognition. And, you know, I have to drop all of that, because this is like a new day for me. And I have to believe that it's possible and let them guide me and get out there and just start doing things, you know. And when I write to 100 professors and I don't get a single one of them that takes me seriously now, I'm going to start on the professors on your side of the pond, you know.
Yeah,
next.
Why not?
We'll see, you know. So just keep, in other words, just to keep at it, you know, and see what happens, you know, and believe that it can happen. So that's where I'm at now. I have all kinds of things occur to me, and I say, I'll try that. And, you know, like I suggested a couple sources when I talked to her before, I wrote that down. I said, okay, try them, you know. And but I talk about synchronicity. I mean, I feel like things are coming into my awareness, you know, that I am to check out on, you know, that I'm not necessarily going to be able to figure it out outside of you. I don't have a business plan, you know what I'm saying? I'm flying by the seat of my pants, feeling guided.
Do you think that the people you connect with somehow rebounding back to you, they're kind of fueling what you do?
I think, talk about synchronicity, for example. I was looking through radios and see, and one of the people I ended up getting interviewed by had a paranormal television show in Haverhill, Massachusetts, where you grew up. That's a little town, you know. I can't imagine having, you know, I guess community access TV. I didn't even know it was big enough to have community TV. So I talked to him and I said, I'm the reincarnation of John Greenleaf Whittier's brother. I mean, I never do that. But this time I did. I just, you know, blurted it right out. And they were interested. We got to know each other. And it was another case where I felt like a connection, you know, a real connection with them. And I drove out to where their studio is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and did the interview live. And, you know, it was definitely a connection of some kind, you know. And is that chance that they just happened to have been in Haverhill and, you know, knew all about, you know, who John Greenleaf Whittier was and so on? You know, I don't know, but it happens.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh no, I was just saying, like we said before, I don't think sometimes there's necessarily a rational reason behind these synchronistic events.
Yeah.
Well, have you got time for a couple synchronicity stories? I'll try to keep them real brief. It has to do with Jeff, who has been on national with his reincarnation, but I was the first person he contacted when I was starting my documentary, so I filmed him before I else did. But in the process, I wanted to have him read on camera by, say, for psychics. And nobody was doing that. Only the spiritualist churches there in England were doing that, were filming their services, you know. No mediums were filming themselves at that point. We're talking 1998. I think it was way before anybody did that. So I had this idea on my own, never having heard of it before. And I was calling different psychics and people trying to arrange it. Like all the psychic school, the Blue Ridge Mountains, there's a school, paranormal school. And I called, and I was trying to get hold of the head of the school, who had been connected with us. She'd been a student of Arthur Ford's, as I recall. And I didn't get hold of her, but I was trying not to give away why I was calling. But I was talking to this fellow named Steve Smith, who was a student. He was a teacher, rather, at the school. And we got to talking. We had common interest in technology and audio and things like that. And finally, he asked me, you know, in an unguarded moment, you know, he asked me what it is that I was interested in. And so I just told him, even though I really shouldn't have, you know, to keep things secret. I said, well, I want to have this fellow, Jeff Keane, read because he believes he's the reincarnation of the Civil War General John B. Gordon. And the fellow says, John B. Gordon? Says, that was my great-great-uncle. So that's the first one, you know. The second one went up to the Antietam battlefield to meet with Jeff, and he was in a Civil War tour. You know, you get together with a bunch of Civil War buffs, and they go around the battlefield and, you know, learn things and whatever. So we were standing in front of the hotel, and we're, I don't know, maybe 30 feet back, and there was an older man and a younger man who were standing closer to the door. I don't remember how, but we're talking 20 feet away from us at least. And in a normal tone of voice, I said to Jeff, oh, you know, one of my ancestors, Fidel O'Biddle, was almost in the battle, and he got sick and couldn't, you know. And the older fellow turns from 20 feet away and says, did you say Fidel O'Biddle? And I said, that was our ancestor.
Oh, wow.
Stuff would happen on Jeff. You know, this is why I hunted him about this website, because I figured if anybody's going to be able to, you know, find this thing, it's going to be him. So, you know, there was another one, too. I can't remember. There was some interesting stuff that would happen. It was not like he was doing it. It was just happening around him, like an aura around him. It was like he had I think past lives. I think that we were Celtics a very long time ago that way. That's why
druids.
Yeah, druids. They're both druids, and there's a lifetime I had back then, and they used to be kind of. They didn't have congregations. They didn't get together. They didn't have organizations. They were just by themselves. They had their own little realms, and they would, you know, travel and meet, but they didn't, you know. And anyway, I remember I had a glimpse of that. But I think he tapped into that synchronicity thing. So where it just, what it tapped into, it's like he tapped into a place where things are just connected, you know. You know, and so he's got that talent from that path, and it just keeps happening around him. That's my guess. That's just a guess.
Well,
yeah,
that's very interesting.
Just so I mentioned, it's 1:57 on the clock.
Okay.
Sorry, you always tell me who you are.
Not over the air.
Sorry, was I meant to say that quietly?
I'm going to put it in Skype.
Oh, sorry. I'm not very good. Right, so,
that's good. That helps me to know, too.
Okay, how many, much longer have we got to go then? Because are you sure it's 1:15?
About 3 minutes. Why? Yeah. To make sure you get enough time to do your.
Well, I'm not so sure, because I've got 15 minutes going here.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
So.
Well, I've got more I can talk about if we have the time.
What?
Because, see, I also have concluded that Matthew and Abby were the original authors of A Christmas Carol and that Charles Dickens didn't write them.
That I can believe.
You can sink your teeth into that, too. Yeah, well, the more that comes out about Dickens, the more you say, well, that's a very spiritual work, A Christmas Carol. Deeply spiritual. It has real metaphysics in it. It has earthbound spirits. It has karma, where the ghost, Marley's ghost, says, I wear the chains I forged in life. That's karma. It has a life review where he's taken back to his childhood, you know. And it has, if you take the ghosts of Christmas, if you take them as spirit guides, it has spirit guides. And it only has the a conversion experience, a spiritual conversion experience. So it's got at least five elements of real, authentic metaphysics in it. Mm. But Dickens was a skeptic. He didn't believe in any of it, and he had so little respect for the metaphysics in that thing. He called it A Ghost Story of Christmas when he subtitled it. He didn't risk it at all. So he couldn't, on the face of it, right there, he couldn't have been an author. You know, you don't have to look any further to know that he couldn't possibly have written it, and certainly he couldn't have written it within 6 weeks.
There was definitely a lot of stealing of other people's work in them days, wasn't there?
Well, there was, and he actually got caught out, you know, and charged even more time. So it wouldn't be the only thing.
But
then you get into, you know, how Matthew and Abby wrote it, and I've got a lot on that, more than we could even get into. But there's an awful lot of evidence that the two of them together collaborated on that piece.
Yeah.
The grave of Ebenezer Scrooge is in the local town I live in.
Is it really?
Yeah. Anyone in it? I didn't know that. Is there anyone in it?
I think it's fake. It was at the original, well, one of the films with Walter C. Scott.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas
Carol.
Yes. Carol was actually filmed literally a mile away from where I'm sitting.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that one.
And they didn't pick up the props.
Some of them got accidentally removed.
Oh, okay.
Maybe somebody has the Ghost of Christmas Future's robe too.
Yeah.
You
know. Right,
somebody has that closet.
I've got a question I want to ask you. Right, in one of these previous lives, when I was getting regressed and I was a nobody and a numpty and everything, I was one of. I was in Oliver's army. Oliver Cromwell's army.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I remember, or I said...
Yeah, you know, we have heard of Cromwell over here. Just, I have to think of it.
Well,
minute.
I was
yeah,
in the battle. Ahead. I was in one of the battles. And I told this hypnotist, I wish I could find the tape. I've got it taped, and it was in the loft somewhere, but I've lost it. That I was a sword through my side. Or somewhere on my body, I can't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
Can these afflictions carry on into the next
Absolutely.
Life?
Absolutely.
You think so?
Absolutely. Now, I had a memory. I can't verify this at all. But my memory was that I was in a city, or I think a city or a small town, a small city in England, there in England. And I was an eccentric. I lived in a big house, and I played the organ. You know, very well. I was like the archetypal guy that plays, you know, Bach fugue, you know, in the dark or whatever. I was that kind of guy. And it was the same thing as with the raven. I mean, I was trying to contact a lost love or figure out how to, you know, kind of get to the other side of life and contact her. So, I mean, that was my life, but I ran out of money. So I was locked out of the house, and I remembered walking around. This is different. I've never told anybody this before. It's very upsetting, really. But I was walking on cobblestone streets, and a group of men attacked me and kicked me to death on the cobblestone streets. And it was cold. It was frosty, you know. And I remembered rising way up in the air and seeing how beautiful this town was in the frost.
Yeah.
You know, from a height, you know, after I left my body, you know, and the contrast of being kicked to death and then rising up and seeing this beauty, you know, and that's all I get. But, you know, that much came to me. So apparently I had a lifetime
and
over there.
And you can't remember the name of the town or any other details?
Nothing. What I told you is everything I remember about.
Mm. Would you be able to, like, look at an aerial view of towns throughout the UK?
Oh, they look so similar. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
You know, a little town with a Tudor architecture in the cobblestones. You know, I mean, towns are like that, right? So
we've still got plenty of them. We've got Bath, York. Mm. You've got, but there's the towns, even these Roman towns and everything. They've all Shrewsbury,
right.
Chester, another one.
They've all
been built up and spread out, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So to recognize that, it would be very, very difficult.
This would be, I would have to guesstimate, we're talking 50 to 75 buildings, something like that, or 100 buildings. Maybe that size.
Maybe very, very old maps and things like that, or photographs. Well, you wouldn't get aerial photographs.
If I went under hypnosis, I might be able to get more. But
I think it would be really useful to do that.
You know, yeah. then I'd have to go through being kicked to death. What I was trying to tell you was that I have had issues, you know, of terrible cramps, yeah. You know, on one side and my, you know, bowels and so on, you know, that I think came from being kicked to death. Mm. You know, I'm still experiencing that, you know. So they do, those things do carry.
Psychosomatic.
Well, yeah, they're psychosomatic, but, I mean, the emotions are very real.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to touch on is that in my study, I can actually prove to a pretty reasonable extent that what carries through is your emotions are fully available to you, but you don't know where they're coming from. But they are past life emotions. That's still with us. And your higher mind, and by higher mind, I call it that, but I have to define it. I mean the values, the turns of your mind, the way you think, the things you think are funny, your values, you know, all of those, that's like your higher mind, not your cognitive memories of I'm Steve and I live in Portland and I, you know, live in such and such an apartment, and those kind of things are gone. I don't remember those things about Matthew, but when I read his writing, I know what he was asleep with, a turn of phrase,
yeah.
You know. I know, oh, I liked, I could feel it. Oh, I liked that.
Hmm.
And I actually, and one of them I proved, because I found one, definitely said, oh, he liked that. And then I found, I think, three more examples where he came back and reused it. You know, the same gag, basically. Yeah.
Is that emotional memory?
That's what I would call emotional memory or intuitive memory. I don't remember.
Emotional memory is something that's brought through from a past life. Yes.
Yeah, it's brought in.
So
it's very much accessible.
If you suffer with depression, or you had something really bad happen to you in a past life, you could be very depressive in this life.
Hey, and that's what past life therapy is all about. The thing you're feeling in context with the thing that actually caused it,
yeah.
To validate it.
And is that the cure, or could that be a cure?
That's the cure, because when you experience it, you know, if I had this terrible pain in my side and I didn't know where it was coming from, and I went, you know, typically what happens is you go to the doctor and you spend thousands and thousands of dollars on tests and they don't know what it is, and they say it's functional, and they, you know, operate and all these things and they can't fix it, and finally you go to a past life therapist. And, you know, they put you under, and in 10 minutes you're remembering being kicked to death, and when you come out, you never have a problem again. It's cured. That's how powerful past life therapy could be if they get to the original event.
Yeah.
You experience it, yeah.
Hmm.
Did anyone hear a voice?
Yes.
About 1 minute past 10.
Well,
I didn't hear one. No.
Hopefully it's been caught. We had this last week.
Huh. I heard a voice. Yeah. And it started just before you spoke, Stephen.
Interesting. Mm.
I definitely heard, and it was not your voice.
It was a male.
And
was it male?
Yeah.
Male.
Yeah, and it said something quite loud. And I actually stopped to listen to it.
Oh, no. I wish I'd known. I didn't hear anything.
I hope we've got it.
Yeah.
But there was definitely
really
something there, because it didn't sound like you.
Well, this is strange, you know, because this week my guest was Jack Roth from J3.
Yeah, he was talking
about J3 Films.
Civil War as well.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He was about the ghosts of Gettysburg. But
maybe we have an old soldier in there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. But but after we'd finished the show, we carried on talking for a little while, and he said, I've been hearing who was talking.
Yeah, it's like somebody brought, he'd brought somebody with him, actually.
It would be interesting if you can isolate that and see what it is.
Yeah, it would be interesting. You know, didn't have a Welsh accent, did he? It's not my Herbert.
I think when you talk about, like, particularly these really emotional times like war and the Civil War, which Jack had spoken a lot about, I think it can trigger people that he may have come in contact with, that, you know, through his research. And I think that's the same with you, Steve, and I think that along the line you've got some residual you know, got some residual paranormal.
It's possible. Spirit,
gosh, though. wouldn't it really be fantastic that. If that voice you just heard was Matthew?
Do you know, I think that's possible.
That would be absolutely fantastic.
Well, see if you can isolate it out and see what they
said. I'm really intrigued by that.
Yeah.
I heard it. I know, because it made me stop. I was actually just hear that.
Just make sure you remember the time.
I think it was about 2:01.
Okay. Right, so we're coming up on the end of the show now, so your books.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first one, which is very, very long, and it's long because I just kept finding stuff, you know. I kept finding it. It's
how many pages?
It's called, it's an e-book, of course, but it's about 2,240 pages.
Wow.
Like, well, that's with a lot of illustrations and a huge appendix and everything, but still, it's just, you know, outrageous. But I think it's a pretty good read, personally, anyway, but you'd have to really be into detective work, you know, to immerse yourself in the detective story. But Matthew Franklin Whittier, in his own words, and that's a pun because whatever I say in there is in his own words because I'm his reincarnation. Mm. So, you know, the other one is called Matthew Franklin Whittier in His Own World, because I wrote that when I came up here to Portland to be in his, you know, and to see things that he had been, you know, that he had seen. Yeah. So I came up into his world, and that's why I call it that. Yeah. That's a little shorter. It's only about 560 pages.
One big one and one little one, then.
You can, but you can, you know, you can cherry pick them. You can sit there and go through there. They're all in, you know, subtitled, you know, chapter titles. Subheadings is what I'm trying to say. You can, you know, go by subheading and read a section for a few pages, and you know, and then you can find another one, and you know, you can still get, you know, quite a bit of interest out of it that way. So you don't have to read the whole thing. Nobody's holding a gun to your head and insisting that you know, you'll definitely get your money's worth. Put it that way.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And both these books can be found on Amazon.com and
they are on Amazon.
.com and .co.uk. I know that it's on .co.uk because I've seen them. Where else can they buy the books? Is there anywhere
else?
Well,
if you get on my website, you'll see that I have a little. It's a free online store, and I've got all of my stuff on the online store as well. Okay. So I'll give you the website. It's www.ial.goldthread.com, GOLDTHREAD.com.
Okay, and if you see that later, I'll put it on the network as well.
I will.
So people can find you easy. And because I think it's an interesting subject, I really do. And the fact that we are have some sort of connection, I like that. I really like that.
It's very interesting. Yeah, I was surprised. I was shocked, actually.
Well, I could have told.
It was so hard, I truly wore it out.
Yeah, I could have told you yesterday, but no, I thought I'd hold back on that for the show and then tell you during the show, you know, because the second time of telling it doesn't sound so good, does it?
But you didn't know that Matthew had, you know, some connection with her.
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, see, that was completely new for both of us.
Yeah, I had no idea. You know, so, but I think it's absolutely brilliant. This is such an interesting subject. You know, we're going to have to do it again.
I love this.
Well, I'd love to come again. There's so much depth to it, really.
There's so much.
There's a whole subject of why is it important, you know, for society. There's a whole issue we didn't get into there either. And I think it's crucial to be reintroduced back into society.
Yeah.
We touched on it a little bit with the artificial intelligence and so on, but there's a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I say thank you to my guest, Stephen, and thank you to Christian for joining me again tonight. And this was
This was
the Paranormal UK Radio Show on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. I was your host, Irene Allen Block, and you can find us everywhere. Just Google us. We're everywhere, people. Okay? Good night.